So I'm going to present results today from an investigation that examined the impact of diabetes self-management education on diabetes process measures, an analysis of behavior risk factor surveillance system data. I want to acknowledge my co-authors at the University of Kentucky, Drs. Hung, Riddell, Shelton, and Holsinger. My time and travel are supported by NERSA T32 award at the Medical College of Wisconsin. So all of the results that I present today in whole or part are those of the authors and not of the government entities listed here, and I have no relationships to disclose. So I have three learning objectives today. Describe diabetes self-management education. We're going to focus on four diabetes-related complications and discuss the impact of diabetes self-management education on diabetes process measures. This is an index of our discussion today. So diabetes mellitus is a group of metabolic diseases where the individual has high levels of blood glucose, and this results from deficits in insulin production, insulin action, or both. Type 1 accounts for 5 to 10% of cases, and type 2, the focus of this investigation, accounts for 90 to 95% of cases. So the International Diabetes Federation estimates that there will be 3 new cases of diabetes every 10 seconds. So just consider the toll for this presentation alone. And there's 1 diabetes-attributed death every 6 seconds, leading to 5.1 million global diabetes-attributed deaths. Nationally, the estimates indicate by year 2050, 1/3 of the U.S. population will have some form of diabetes. So diabetes has companions, and those companions are diabetes-related complications, and that's really the gateway to the premature mortality. Cardiovascular disease is the number one comorbidity. For example, the 2010 age-adjusted hospitalization rates for heart attack were 1.8 times higher among adults 20 years or older with diabetes. Individuals 40 years or older with diabetes, 28.5% of those individuals have diabetic retinopathy. And if you just look at this diagram of the body, you just see diabetes toll that it takes. And this diagram actually negates to mention periodontitis as well as hearing impairment that are also two related comorbidities. So we do have some clinical measures and self-measures that we can do to sort of delay or prevent the onset of these diabetes-related complications. So let's focus here on the right-hand side of this diagram. So the numbers that are presented in the orange portion of the bar show actually the delta in the process measures that we see on the left-hand side. So there's this premise, let's start at the bottom. There's this premise that if we can just get individuals in to see their healthcare provider at least once a year, they'll be more likely to perform self-care as well as receive the other clinical care that they need. But if we look at the delta, it's 15.1%. So that lends us to believe that individuals are actually seeing their healthcare provider at least once a year as it relates to their diabetes. But as we continue looking at these bars, it doesn't necessarily correlate with them actually performing self-care or receiving the clinical care that they need. So looking at the next 5 measures, there's a delta ranging from 31.5% to 38.9%. And then attending diabetes self-management education, 42.6%. And a delta of, you know, nearly 50% of individuals with diabetes who do not receive their annual flu vaccine, and 57.5% who've never had a pneumococcal vaccine. So there are great disparities in comprehensive care, which leaves millions of individuals at greater risk for diabetes-related complications, which are the gateway to mortality. So what can we sort of do about this? Or what do we hypothesize as sort of part of the population-based solution? We looked at diabetes self-management education, which is sort of defined as a model that presents the individual with the knowledge, the skills, and ability for diabetes self-care. It incorporates the needs, the goals, and the life experiences of the individual. And this framework is based on evidence-based standards. And there's some previous research that's shown that individuals who've attended DCME are more likely to have clinical measures such as their clinical foot examination, hemoglobin A1C, as well as dilated eye examination. And that the DCME course attendance actually gives the patient knowledge, confidence, and expectations, and more importantly, information, and it increases their care seeking or seeking of services, as well as self-management. The primary research objective of this study was to examine if there's an association between DSME attendance and preventive self-care and clinical process measures among individuals with type 2 diabetes, looking specifically at four process measures and four endpoints: daily self-examination of feet, clinical foot examination, at least two hemoglobin 1A1Cs, and dilated eye examination. So when we look at these four process measures, think back to the earlier diagram of the body and just the detrimental toll that not receiving this preventive care can lead. Our data source for this investigation was the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System data. It's the nation's largest randomly digitized survey of non-institutionalized adults. And the BRFSS sort of collects information on demographic as well as health status. And then they also have these sort of specialized modules. And we examined the demographic data from the core data, as well as looking at the diabetes module, which asks questions specifically related to diabetes. And so in the 2009 survey year, you actually had 40 states that actually implemented that diabetes module. So it was really rich during that time period. 33,433 individuals reported that yes, they have diabetes, and then also had a valid yes or no response that they attended DSME. Now the BRFSS doesn't necessarily inquire if an individual is type 1 or type 2, so we used a proxy to try to estimate the type 2 diabetes burden, looking at age of diagnosis, if an individual was 30 years or greater, and if they were insulin or non-insulin dependent, we classified them as type 2. And then also if the age of diagnosis was less than 30 years of age and the individual was non-insulin dependent, we classified them as type 2. For our analyses, we looked at bivariate analyses. So the individuals who attend DSME versus those who do not attend DSME. Classic weighted descriptive statistics and significance looking at the chi-square. We did four separate logistic regressions, really trying to isolate those things that are associated with each of those singular process measures. And that's why we did four separate logistic regressions for those four primary endpoints. Adjusted prevalence estimates and 95% confidence intervals, and we looked at everything at a statistical significance of 0.05. And our analyses were conducted in SAS and Sudan to account for the complex sampling frame of the BRFSS data. So let's present some results. So we're starting now just looking at the characteristics. Age group and race and ethnicity were statistically different between the individuals who attended DSME versus those who did not attend DSME. So let's start with the individuals who attended DSME. The green arrows pointing up lets us know that they were significantly more likely as compared to those who did not attend DSME. So among those who attended DSME, they were significantly more likely to be 55 to 64 years of age, be white only non-Hispanic, black only non-Hispanic. And unfortunately, given our statistical rules of engagement, we have to aggregate Asian, Pacific Islander, Asian American, Alaskan American, and other into a singular category, but they were also statistically more likely to receive DSME. For those who did not attend DSME, they were statistically more likely to be 65 years of age or older, and also to self-report being of Hispanic origin. Education, marital status, and veteran status were also statistically significant. Those who attended DSME were more likely to be college graduates, to be married, and to report being a veteran. Those who did not attend DSME were statistically more likely to have less than a high school education, to be previously married. And in closing with sort of the general characteristics of the respondents, income, general health status, general health insurance, and insulin use were also statistically significant. Those who attended DSME earned $50,000 or greater, reported being in excellent or very good health, had general health insurance, and also used insulin to manage their type 2 diabetes. Those who did not attend DSME were statistically more likely to earn less than $15,000, to report being in fair or poor health. So the next slide is going to present just the regression, the results from each of those separate four logistic regression models. And we're going to start with daily self-examination of feet. DSME, veteran status, and insulin use increase one's likelihood of daily self-foot examination. Individuals who attended DSME were 0.83 times more likely to perform daily self-feet examination. 0.45 times likely if the individual was a veteran, and I can sort of postulate that that's just a part of being the standard if one is in military service, that your uniform and everything is part of the mantra of being a soldier, so one gives great attention to their feet. And then insulin use, those individuals were 0.85 times more likely for daily self-examination of feet. And probably these individuals engage more often with the healthcare system because they're really just trying to manage their insulin dosage. Interestingly, individuals who reported being in excellent or good health were less likely to check their feet. So maybe if they, you know, self-report that they're in excellent or good health, they think that everything is fine and they don't need to necessarily perform daily self-foot examination. For the clinical examination of the feet, so actually seeing a podiatrist, hopefully having a thorough clinical exam, DSME and insulin use increase the likelihood if an individual attended DSME over two full times as likely to have a clinical foot examination. So that goes back to that increased knowledge of what they need, what they should have, what they should do, and also care seeking and seeking of services. And again, we find that insulin increases the likelihood of another process measure. And mainly, again, we can just postulate that an individual that's on insulin may be more integrated into the healthcare system because it takes some time to meet the right dosage for insulin. Hemoglobin A1C testing, at least two tests within the previous year. We find again DSME increases the likelihood of yet a third process measure, almost three times as likely here. Insulin use increases an individual's likelihood of receiving two or more hemoglobin A1C tests within the year. And then also fruit and vegetable consumption, at least five, increases. They're 44 times as likely to have at least two hemoglobin A1C tests in the year. And lastly, dilated eye examination. If an individual attended DSME, they were 52 times as likely to have a dilated eye examination. If they had general health insurance, they were 52 times as likely to receive a dilated eye exam. And one of the things I would postulate here is we know that vision insurance is a luxury insurance. It's not part of your general health insurance. But if an individual has general health insurance and they're engaging in the healthcare system, they're probably more likely to be able to get a referral to a free program or a discounted program that they can then go to and maybe get their dilated eye exam. And insulin use also increased the likelihood 46 times as likely to have a dilated eye exam. But interestingly, the individual who consumed five or more fruits and vegetables a day were less likely to receive a dilated eye exam. So maybe we're taking literally that if we eat our carrots, it leads to good eye health. So just to recap, and I just want to sort of highlight, you know, the two things that we found were really sort of be able to taper in on how we're going to increase an individual receiving these process measures or performing the self-care. We see that DSME is strongly correlated with all four process measures as well as insulin use. So So in discussion, we found that there's a strong association between DSME attendance and four process measures, four diabetes-related process measures, and between insulin use and four diabetes process measures, which is going to become very important because more and more each day, individuals with type 2 diabetes are being managed with insulin or insulin in some type of oral therapy versus just oral therapy as it was many decades ago. Limitations of this data, of course, it's cross-sectional, so we're looking at DSME and the process measure in tandem, and then also the birth data. The sampling bias is looking at non-institutionalized adults, and we know individuals that are in our correctional facilities have higher increase in risk of diabetes and its complications, and the BRFSS does not sample those individuals, and the data are self-reported. Some of the implications, you know, DSME, we really should look at it as a population-based response to address diabetes related complications, because if we continue to look at them fragmented as each section of the body and focus on it, we're going to continue to miss the mark. And some of the future directions, really look at the determinants of DSME, because we know if there's that gap of 50 or so percent of individuals who don't ever attend a diabetes self-management education course, it's either related to the fact they never received the referral, or they received the referral and they never attended. So we really just need to deep dive into some of those characteristics of referrals and attendance to close that gap. And then also the program structure. They range from different length, so length, language, literacy, and culture. It's simply not enough just to translate materials into another language, per se, but we really need to look at culture and literacy as we look at the structure of DSME. And anytime we speak to anything that relates to the healthcare system, we need to look at the reimbursement structure. So initial diagnosis, refresher courses, and also for individuals who have pre-diabetes. In most cases, when you look at programs like DPP and some of the others, the criteria are so stringent that individuals cannot be enrolled in those programs. And it's unfortunate that we wait until someone crosses the threshold and then we try to get them help. So again, I'd like to acknowledge my co-investigators at the University of Kentucky, as well as the Medical College of Wisconsin Academic Primary Care T32 program. Dr. John Moyer is my primary mentor. Dr. Linda Moore is the PI of the T32 grant, and Ms. Tess Chandler is the program coordinator, as well as my other T32 fellows. And these are references that I use to develop this talk. And thank you for your time and journeying with me along this call. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Jackson. Please help me thank every presenter here. And now we have time for some questions. The lady in the back.
Until things are at the edge to where there's a speculation that you may have diabetes. Like the hemoglobin A1C test, they're not very expensive.
Right.
But for an individual to walk into a healthcare facility to say, you know, I'd like to be tested for diabetes, if you don't have this whole list of criteria, then more than likely your doctor's not going to test for it and you have to pay out of pocket. So that's, you know, one of the challenges that we'll have to address when it comes to our healthcare system, because if this child would have gone into the doctor, they would have looked at him, healthy, athletic, surely it can't be diabetes.
Right. And there's a pillar, when you look at it, you're like, wow.
And so now, again, one of the challenges with the pediatric population is the onset of type 2. It used to be where, you know, you think of our pediatric population as always type 1, but now that more and more the children are being diagnosed with type 2. And so I just think that we have to, you know, advocate to our healthcare system that we just need to have this as, you know, part of standard testing and give paint look at them because they're children and say that everything's okay.
And my second question.
I would like to respond to that question as well. It's not just children, but adolescents. If you're adolescents and they have a lot of hormonal changes, we have seen a lot of teenagers getting diabetes, and that's linked to stress, that's linked to hormonal, but it's also linked to obesity. So they may be fit, they may be not, and I'm not sure if they would run an A1C, but if they would just run a fasting, you know, blood sugar, they could run a random A.
A parent would have to beg for that.
So that's a problem. But I have seen a lot of teenagers and children. When I was in Texas, Texas Children's Hospital, my colleague there diagnosed a 5-year-old with type 2. A 5-year-old. Guess what was his weight? 150 pounds. So if you expect, I mean, do you think that child could take care of himself? You know, I'm sure the, you know, it's a single parent or, you know, dual parent household. It's just difficult when it comes to like self-management and education.
And I think we're going to also have to what's going to be important in the future too is maybe doing home visits. You know, the family and so forth.
Okay, who else?
Thank you for your presentation. I was curious about those areas in West Virginia where your people were doing better than the state percentage. Do you have any characteristics about those areas?
Most of the, you know, counties that did better, again, it's not better than nationally, but it's better than the state average of 15%. The Monongahela County, for example, is one of them, and our very high socioeconomic status and education, Morgantown, the unemployment rate is 4%, below the national average. We have hospitals, we have universities, we have pharmaceutical companies. So those are some of the driving forces that we're seeing where people have access to care, they go for wellness checkup, and they are educated enough. So that's my best guess for that.
Yes? Thank you all for awesome presentations on community-based diabetes, the screening and education. I have a specific question for Dr. Pack about the patient health education in outpatient settings. You were talking about the doctor's visit. The doctor was seeing the patients for X amount of time. But I'm wondering if the education might be given by another part of that medical staff, maybe the nurse educator, because the diabetes and endocrinology is the nurse educator. Can you speak to how your numbers pan out?
They end up not having information. How many medical steps do we have? Like, you know, traditional physician assistance. But we have some fact information, like the physician practice time, for example, solo clinic, small group of training, large group of hospital. So I think that could be some fact information.
Okay, anyone else? Any more questions or comments?
I have a question for Dr. Jackson. Why did you use 2009 workforce since we have 2015 out now?
So if you look at 2013 and you look at the diabetes module, which was the very rich, only 13 states implemented the module. In 2009, 40 states implemented the module. And for some reason, that's a disturbing trend. I don't know if states are starting to capture that data elsewhere. But if you look from 2009 to date, the implementation of the, because I funding, I guess, maybe, right? Because you have to pay extra for the diabetes model. The number of states that implement the diabetes optional model has gone down. So 2009 is the last year where there were rich data for most states.
Any other questions? Yeah?
Yes. I just would like to ask Dr. Jackson, have you heard anything, I've been doing some research about viral infections or contributing factors and risk factors for development of diabetes?
Yeah, there are a number of things that are sort of secondary causes. People tend to think that it's only obesity that leads to diabetes, but there are a plethora of things that can lead to diabetes, and that's also a factor. And there's also, was just reading about dementia and early onset of dementia, and so this whole premise of a type 3 diabetes that's brought and caused on by dementia. So there are a number of factors across the entire platform. My sort of main next step agenda now is really looking at the use of insulin, especially among vulnerable populations. Insulin is very expensive. So if individuals can't really afford the oral metformin regime, how then do they afford the metformin plus the insulin? Or if they're in a certain state where it becomes insulin only. And you have to think, I don't know, the last time you've seen a needle, insulin is very mathematical. So if someone has low literacy, if they have visual acuity, if they already start to have some tremor, it's going to be very difficult to self-manage your diabetes if you're on an insulin regime. So not just psychologically, but financially, and then also from a literacy standpoint. You know, the individual is trying to hold the vial, trying to measure, if they have some visual acuity, just really trying to see the needle, they're going to take too much, too little. They're going to forget to take the air bubble out, and it's going to constantly lead to, as we see, an increase in hospitalization because of, you know, maintaining being hyperglycemic.
Then, just to add on to the question, it lends you to more education if, in fact, that patient goes from an oral hypoglycemic to a multiple
right.
So you're going to need somebody like that home visiting person going out and saying, now what did you do today? How do we measure it tomorrow? What do you have to do to, you know, improve your management?
Correct. And that was one of the implications that we really need to look at the structure of the education. Because we always want the patient to come back to the clinic, to come back to the hospital, and then the system sort of wants to downplay the education that the patient receives in the community, at a local church, at a healthcare center, or what have you. And we really need to look at the structure. Where is the best site? Who is the best person? And sometimes it's not always a clinical provider alone. So we need the clinician as well as someone else, you know, in the support system, especially with insulin. I tell you, I see it in the clinic, and it can be very psychologically frustrating, especially for someone who has low literacy levels. So you think that, oh, they're just the numbers on the side of the needle, but for someone who can't read, everything's a blur. So we speak of health literacy, but we have to get back to the core.
And it's more expensive by the pen, which has the number on the side.
Correct, and of course, most insurance and Medicaid are not going to cover the pen. So then we end up with individuals being labeled as non-compliant or non-adherent, but really we need one-on-one focus and then the pressure of the home health visit to come to make sure that I still understand that the individual has this under control. You can't just show someone once or twice in the clinic and you're rushing to get to the next patient. So that's what I say about the structure of how we structure the LIMP. And maybe it's just a model that just focuses on how to use insulin and not the whole platform. Because I have some patients when I'm in the clinic scouting that say, well, I don't want to come for 6 weeks and they're going to talk about nutrition and I already know the food. I just need to know about the medication. But the program from the way the insurance is built, you just can't come to that one model.
And I'll respond to that. I do diabetes education programs in the community. And a lot of participants want to try volunteer program, they're doing well, they want to scale back their insulin or their, so, you know, so that, again, they want to go back, they want to learn, they want to feel great after they, you know, lost some weight and improved their lifestyle. But again, going back to the doctors is expensive for them. $40 could be a lot of money.
And so $20 is not a lot of money, but $20 is all we need between the decision of not being late again on the rent this month and the bus pass that you need to get to work. So when I say we put things in context, we merely need to put everything in context, in the social context of the patient.
And you call for an appointment, and it's 3 or 6 months left.
I actually have one last question, and I want to ask to our presenters if you have any experience with applications, you know, like applications for smartphones or computers that has been useful for diabetes care or management.
Yeah, when I was in Texas, we had a night run to use the app, a PDA, and after 2 years, unfortunately, the numbers didn't really, the A1C didn't really drop as much as we, again, with the PDA, because we give them the phone, we had to have the app that was uploaded there. So I don't know, that was my only experience. There could be other apps that are doing better. But I generally use the app, again, I do this diabetes program for post prevention management. It's called PACER. And they can count their PACER. I have that in my phone as well, so I don't need a pedometer. It will count how many steps I walk. There are other apps with tracking their blood glucose or anything else. So I have a lot of my participants who would like to use those apps.
Yeah, I know some of those apps, but I'm always concerned when it comes to the literacy level and then the language.
Right.
Because a lot of times, even with the apps that I've seen, when they send the message, it's very academic. Because it's trying to measure something that someone needs to go back to. You don't even, as a researcher myself, that it needs to be measured. And so it's not just enough to translate, but you actually have to put it in the context to the literacy level of the patients you're trying to reach. And I think that's sometimes where a lot of the apps may miss the
one. I agree. But I do ask, and I need to work with teens with diabetes because they've had diabetes for maybe a couple of years, for many years, and all of a sudden they decide they're never going to be diabetic again, and just stop. Which would change. So we really need to do the re-education and stuff. But they like the app, and I usually go back to only using the app to tell about the food value or the patient value, you know. Value just to get the carbs. They can count their carbs more accurately, give them a better look at it. And again, it's based on literacy, interest, if they're really into the little phone thing, or if they even have their own cell phone, and whether in fact they can do the actual mathematics, which is some of my kids use. Yeah. The ethnography
level. Yeah, very much.
I just want to add that you are completely right, but you also get the other case where the kid is really smart and they end up knowing more than the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
I have seen it. Well, thank you very much for coming today. We appreciate your interest and your comments and your questions, and let's give it one more time.